a warm welcome to John Lombard.
Great, Ann. Thanks very much for that introduction. And I do want to just thank Ann specifically for helping make this book possible. It would not have been co-published by the University of Washington Press without her help, and that's really key to my getting the message out. So I'm very, very happy for all the help that she's provided on that. Now, when I was introduced to speak about this book at Town Hall a few months ago, the executive director described it as taking a realpolitik approach to conservation. And he meant that as a compliment, and I took it as such, although I don't usually think of myself as a kind of soulmate to Henry Kissinger. I am proud that the book takes a hard-headed, realistic view at the priorities for conservation in this region and what we need to do to get there. But this morning, I also want to leave you with some inspiration about a possible alternative future that we can achieve in this region. My book, Saving Puget Sound, develops a practical proposal to conserve the natural heritage of the Puget Sound region in the face of long-term population growth and climate change. It's not focused just on the marine waters of Puget Sound. It's not focused just on salmon, though they've gotten so much of the attention over the past few years. It really does try to step back and look at the totality of our natural heritage across what I call the eco-region. And that includes the entire area draining to Puget Sound, as well as the Strait of Juan de Fuca, but also includes two additional areas I'll be talking about in a few slides that don't drain to the Sound, but that are very important for how that whole landscape functions ecologically at the terrestrial level. And today I'm going to focus on what I think are the two most important arguments in the book. What's a vision for conservation across that entire ecoregion, and how can we pay for it? Because conservation at that scale doesn't come cheap. Now, before I get into the heart of my talk, though, I do want to just acknowledge that anybody who wants to propose really fundamental changes to the way we manage things as central to society as land and water needs to have a good answer to the question, why? You know, why should we make changes that would really be so difficult? And I think in this case, there are actually many good answers to the question why that all strengthen and reinforce each other. But I'm going to focus just on two this morning. You know, first of all, just simply the economic benefits of conservation. I would argue that these, looked at just by themselves, would justify the sort of measures that I'm proposing. When economists look at what makes the Puget Sound region competitive at a national and an international level, the most important economic asset that we have in this region is our natural environment, the beauty of that environment and the accessibility of that environment to the millions of people who live here. That's one of the major factors, really the leading factor, that attracts the highly educated and highly mobile labor force that's really central to all of our most important companies. Now, there are many other economic benefits from conservation, but the other one that I would want to stress is that we get a whole variety of services from the ecosystems around us for free that we either can't get any other way or that would be very expensive to try to replace artificially. And these here are five of the most important ones. The other argument the other answer to the question why that I want to stress is one that was abstract to me up until about 2 years ago. There's my daughter here who just will turn 8 months tomorrow, and my son and I out on the coast, he just turned 2 years, 2 years old last week. You know, we tend to talk about these issues in terms of trying to protect our quality of life, and that's important. But I think, you know, the really more compelling argument is what's going to be the quality of their lives and the lives of their children and grandchildren, the lives of future generations. Because when we're really looking at the threats to this region, you know, the most significant ones are ones that are just going to accumulate over the next 50 to 100 years unless we start addressing them now. And, you know, I, and I think most people around here, want to ensure to the greatest extent possible, you know, that our children and grandchildren can enjoy a Puget Sound region that's at least as wild and as natural as we've had the chance to enjoy. You know, and thankfully, I'm not the only one who feels that way. The timing for my book really could not have been better. I certainly had no idea when I started 5 years ago that it would be published about 2 weeks before the governor would release her Puget Sound Partnership proposal. That, in turn, was based in large part on the shared strategy for Puget Sound, which has really been the most collaborative effort to develop a recovery plan for listed species, in this case salmon, for any place in the country. And the other major initiative that I think is important to note here in the central Puget Sound region is the Cascade Land Conservancy's Cascade Agenda that tries to look out 100 years ahead at the sort of pressures that we are having from population growth and climate change and say, what are the most important places on the landscape we need to try to protect right now? And these are all, you know, very laudable developments. I've participated in every one of them to some extent. I support them all, but they all have limitations, and if they have serious enough limitations that if we stay within them, we really are not going to keep faith with our children and future generations. You know, when you if you take a look at the governor's proposal, if you look hard, you'll have to look at page 43 of Appendix A, but that's the scientific report, Appendix A, from the governor, and it actually says straightforwardly that the governor's own scientists say, you know, the partnership proposal isn't actually sufficient to reach the goals that it's setting out for itself. And some of the primary reasons for that are really here in these other four cases. You know, first of all, there's really almost a complete lack of commitments for what does it take to actually address the habitat issues that are included in that proposal. You know, I was watershed coordinator at King County for the whole Lake Washington watershed for about 5 years, working with 28 cities and two counties in that area. And when our watershed plan was ready to go out for approval by the jurisdictions, the elected officials that I worked with required that the adoption ordinance for the plan specify that in approving this plan, you are not obligating yourself to implement anything within it. And that is very common for watershed plans across the entire Puget Sound region. They've got generally so many good ideas, some good recommendations, but really no commitment to follow through at this point. They, as well as the Cascade Agenda and the rest of the governor's proposal beyond the shared strategy piece, really don't address water quantity at all. They don't address the challenges that we're facing in a region with limited supplies of water and millions of new people that are going to be coming in here over the next century. They don't fundamentally consider the region as an ecosystem. The governor's plan really focuses primarily on the marine area to the extent that it focuses upland. It's incorporating the shared strategy. The shared strategy, in turn, is really focused just on one or two listed species. It's not focused at all on terrestrial species. The Cascade Land Conservancy, the Cascade Agenda, I think, is great within central Puget Sound. It stops at the north, at the Snohomish County boundary, and in the south, at the Pierce County boundary. And they recognize, you know, that that's not the way ecosystems work. But not only is that the case, but it's actually cutting out the parts of the region that are really most important ecologically for how Puget Sound functions. And lastly, they don't approach habitat at a landscape scale. The shared strategy and the watershed plans that, you know, that I was involved creating, they generally approach habitat by saying, you know, we're going to acquire this parcel here, we're going to try to restore this reach there. But they really aren't addressing how the landscape itself is being transformed over time and how that can overwhelm and will overwhelm, if we don't address it, anything that we try to do down at the stream level. Now the good news, I think, you know, one of the many pieces of good news actually in here is that these are issues that I think we really can address here within this region. They all are fundamentally under our control. You know, it's kind of an obvious point, but something that we don't usually, I think, consider, that when we're talking about conservation, we're really fundamentally talking about how land and water are managed. And land use is basically governed by state law, state frameworks like the Growth Management Act that local governments implement and refine at the local level. States control water rights and water withdrawals. States have generally been delegated the lead responsibility to implement the Clean Water Act. Local governments have the lead for stormwater programs that are typically addressing the most important water pollution issues that remain. The federal government definitely does have some important roles to play, but I would argue that they're all really pretty peripheral to the central issues that we in this region essentially can control and can therefore determine our own future. Now, the two biggest challenges, I think everybody would agree, are population growth and climate change. Right now, we've got about 4 million people here in the Puget Sound region, and that's likely to double at some point in this century, 8 million or so. And perhaps more significantly, we're not just growing fast, you know, we're growing unevenly. And in general, the areas that are growing fastest are the areas where the natural resources are most valuable. Out here in the Skagit, down here in the Nisqually, Olympic Peninsula, we may be looking at tripling or quadrupling our population over this century. And with climate change, you know, it does seem finally that most people outside of the White House have agreed that the facts are in, it's happening, and we need to both, you know, begin to take some serious measures to try to minimize what effects that may have in the future, but also to adapt to what the consequences of climate change are going to be. And the biggest consequences for us here ecologically are first of all, we're going to have a reduced snowpack. It's going to change the flows in our streams mean that in the summer and early fall, there's both less money or less water for the natural environment and less water for us at the very same time as our population grows and our demand can increase. The higher temperatures are going to mean that where vegetation is located changes, and vegetation essentially is habitat. So we're going to see ecosystem shift, and species are going to need to shift with it. They may not be able to shift fast enough. Water temperatures will also rise. And then the sound, you know, that most significantly, I think, could affect the plankton that are really at the food web, or at the base of the food web for our whole marine ecosystem. But the good news here is that really, you know, when scientists recommend the sort of actions that you would want to take to address these issues, by and large, they have the same sort of actions that they would recommend to address these issues. And that's really to work with nature, to work with natural ecological processes and the basic natural systems that we have surrounding us. Now, what exactly does that mean? Well, unfortunately, we haven't really had a truly comprehensive, in-depth study of Puget Sound as an ecosystem, the whole ecoregion. But there has been such a study done to the south of us in the Willamette River Basin that we can learn a tremendous amount from. The Willamette is just a little bit smaller than the overall Puget Sound Basin. The ecosystems are very similar. And their population, though it's a smaller base, is growing at about the same rate. They also are almost certain to double in population this century. And there was a six-year, $10 million study funded by the EPA and involving a really very good group of technical folks as well as a group of stakeholders representing a wide variety of interests from this whole 10,000 square mile area that looked ahead and established what they called three alternative futures. And both as a matter of fairness and to recognize that there's only so much you can do at the local or regional level about population growth, they said, you know, every one of these alternative futures has to accommodate the same number of people. They all have to accommodate doubling their population. The planned trend scenario would do that under existing programs and policies and regulations. The development scenario would put more issues of land and water management under market forces. And the conservation scenario would say, let's let the natural features of the landscape be the primary determinant of where we focus our conservation efforts and where we anticipate at least localized impacts from new growth, because there will be at least localized impacts from growth. And to cut to the chase, you know, the most important result from that study was that even with doubling the population, they found that taking that conservation scenario approach could actually improve most indicators of ecological health across that landscape. It's a somewhat complicated chart, but the central bar here is intended to represent current conditions. The far set of bars is trying to represent what things might have been like back around 1850, before there was much Euro-American presence in the region. And we actually can estimate that fairly well through General Land Office records and other archives. The second set of bars is the conservation scenario, and not only are almost all the bars up, but some are up quite a ways relative to that 1850 standard. The third set, and this is really the other most important take-home message, is despite having some of the best growth management laws in the country, the planned trend scenario was basically down across the board. And lastly, the development scenario, not terribly surprisingly, down even further in most cases. Now, what were the key factors for making that conservation scenario succeed? Well, maybe the most significant one, certainly the least intuitive, was rural sprawl, trying to address rural sprawl. We're used to talking about urban sprawl. But urban areas make up a relatively small part of the overall landscape. They're about 5% of the Willamette Basin today, growing to at most 6.8% under the development scenario. There's a lot more rural area. The natural values are much higher in those areas. And as we saw earlier, in most cases, actual growth rate tends to be higher in those areas as well. There's much more at stake ecologically. And what the conservation scenario did in rural areas was focus on trying to preserve the natural vegetation cover to the greatest extent possible and to cluster new development away from the most sensitive habitats. I think with this group, the next three issues are I think probably going to be easy to recognize, but you know, the second most important factor was trying to enhance natural interactions between rivers and their floodplains, to remove levees where possible, or at least set them back so that the most dynamic, you know, most complex habitat really across the terrestrial landscape has that chance to form and develop. They also looked at trying to restore more natural flow patterns in their rivers by managing our water withdrawals differently. Mature forest, they didn't say you cut down no trees, but they did say where you've got substantial stands of trees that are at least 80 years old or older, and they're located where they can complement old growth reserves, that you do focus your conservation efforts there. And lastly, riparian vegetation. Not just trying to protect the vegetation along our streams and lake shores and wetlands, but actually restore it to the greatest extent possible. So you've got a continuous band of riparian vegetation, which usually makes up the most important single habitat for the widest variety of species across the landscape. Every one of those priorities would apply here as well. They're all crucial. Nothing would really change, but there would be a number of priorities that we would need to add because we are fundamentally different from the Willamette in a number of ways. And the most significant, of course, is that we've got a big marine estuary running right through the middle of our ecosystem. And pretty much every study that's ever really looked at Puget Sound has focused on the importance of the marine shoreline as both the most productive and the most sensitive part of that whole marine ecosystem. It's not going to have the same conservation value everywhere, but it's everywhere. It's going to be an important issue as to what happens there. Salmon refuge basins. The Willamette study, you know, for a number of different reasons, didn't really focus that much on salmon. But salmon are obviously a big deal up here. And that same research that I mentioned earlier about relating how the landscape relates to salmon or relates to stream habitat and how what happens there can overwhelm things going on at the stream level. But it's actually found, and this most of this research has actually been done in some way or another through University of Washington. It's found that actually the biggest drops in the habitat value of streams tend to occur at relatively low levels of development, much lower than your typical rural development. Now, with millions of new people coming and much of this rural area being privately held, we aren't going to be able to say, you know, no new development in rural areas at all. But what we can say is let's target refuge basins across the landscape strategically in key watersheds and say in those places we really are going to try to have as little clearing and development as possible. Hood Canal Forests. I think, you know, people here are probably quite well aware of what's been in the news for a while now about the problems with water quality in Hood Canal and the so-called dead zone down in the southern part of the canal. Protecting the forests around Hood Canal is crucial to the water quality of Hood Canal, but it also has two other important values. On the Kitsap side, it's some of our most important bird habitat in the region. And on the Olympic Peninsula side, it's some of our most important amphibian habitat. Now, the next two are the two places where I go beyond areas just draining to Puget Sound as being priority places on our landscape. The Snoqualmie Pass area is really the narrow choke point between the North Cascades and the South Cascades. It's a crucial wildlife corridor that's going to become all that much more important with climate change as species are forced to migrate north. We've got not only a big interstate highway running right through there, but we've got very fragmented land ownership due to just historical choices made more than 100 years ago. Trying to address those issues to restore connectivity in that area is really one of the highest priorities for our region. And last, in the South Puget Sound area, this is an area that doesn't drain to the Sound, that the landscape there was largely created by the same glaciers that came through and carved out the Sound. And elsewhere in the Sound, where it pressed down on the soil with a mile-high sheet of ice that created the till layer we've got in so much of the rest of the region, when those glaciers melted out, they melted out to the south, and they created a very porous soil landscape and a very different overall ecosystem. You know, we've got 6 subspecies of gopher in the prairies of South Puget Sound that all have been petitioned for listing under the Endangered Species Act. We've got butterflies and birds and other species that are seriously threatened there and that are not found anywhere else on the landscape. So that really is another area that requires its own special focus here across our region. So any strategy that's trying to develop a conservation proposal across this wide region, that it needs to really address these four questions. You know, where are we going to allow localized impacts to occur? Because there are going to be significant localized impacts for millions of new people. Where are we going to do our best to avoid new impacts? Where are we seriously going to use all the tools that we have, whether it's regulations or acquisitions or compensation to landowners, to really minimize and in some cases eliminate any new impacts? Where are we going to actually make up for past harm? If we're going to see significant localized impacts in many parts of the landscape, to not have large net losses across the overall landscape, we need to have other places where we're going to have net gains. Where are we going to focus that? And how are we going to pay for all this? Again, conservation at this scale doesn't come cheap. We're going to need money to acquire the most important habitats where we really don't want to see any new developments. We're going to need money to restore habitats on a scale that we've never seriously attempted before. I think we're going to need money to pay landowners for ecological services that go beyond a regulatory baseline. I think we need a regulatory baseline that sets expectations for what landowners owe each other, owe to the wider community, owe to the ecosystems in which they live. But I think we're also going to find that in the most important parts of our landscape, you know, what we really need to accomplish there is not going to be possible through regulation alone. There will need to be new mechanisms to compensate landowners. And lastly, there are going to be a whole variety of crucial programs that aren't strictly based on land conservation, such as water conservation, planning for stormwater impacts, and so on. How much would the whole thing cost? You know, no one can really tell you for sure, but my guess is about $10 billion over a 20-year period. And that's pretty much in line with the sort of cost the governor has estimated for their proposal. It's pretty much in line with what the Cascade Land Conservancy has developed for the Cascade Agenda. Even though no one can tell you the exact amount, you know, there's no question that's going to be a big chunk of change, and it's going to be a particularly big chunk of change in an era where we've had citizen initiatives over more than the last decade limit tax revenues at both the state and the local levels. And we've seen natural resource spending, which never was a big slice of the pie, get cut even further. Well, I would argue that the best way to address that problem of a lack of funds for conservation is addressing another problem that in many ways is even more fundamental. Now, I don't know whether current Exxon executives are allowed to say the same things as former Exxon executives, but what Mr. Dahl is saying here is really discussed in just about any Economics 101 textbook, although it's not usually put in these stark of terms. The free market does a good job at allocating resources efficiently when prices take actual costs into account. When prices don't take important costs into account, the free market can misallocate resources, sometimes disastrously. And there is no better example of that than environmental costs. Now, the solution to that issue anyway of addressing more than enough money for an ambitious conservation program is what I call ecological pricing, or a little bit more colorfully, environmental sin taxes. Just like the taxes that we've got on alcohol and cigarettes that are theoretically justified by the public costs that we all bear from those behaviors, this would be a way of using taxes and fees to try to incorporate ecological costs into economic decisions. There's a whole variety of ways that you can do that. If you put them all together, you could easily raise $1 billion a year here in this region. I'm going to focus just on the first three here: a water withdrawal fee, a gasoline sales tax, and an environmental impact fee on new development. In this region, like most of the rest of the world, we don't pay a dime to take water out of our streams and our aquifers. When we pay our water bills, we're paying just simply for transporting that water to our taps. for storing it until we're ready to use it, and to clean it to meet drinking water standards. But you can't take more than 250 billion gallons a year out of an ecosystem without having profound ecological impacts on the species that evolved to depend on that water and the flow patterns that we're changing. If we set a tax or a fee that averaged just a tenth of a cent per gallon, which would be only about $5 a month for a typical family, we could raise up to $250 million a year across the region. A tax or fee could be higher in summer when ecological costs are greater, or higher for larger withdrawals to encourage conservation. But if it simply averaged just a tenth of a cent per gallon, we could be raising this sort of money. And there's not a direct one-to-one correspondence, because this could lead to some substantial conservation, and that would be a good thing. We could raise a lot more by extending the sales tax to gasoline. Right now, gasoline is exempt from the sales tax, along with food. It's one of the two consumer goods, one of the few consumer goods that are exempt from the sales tax. We do, of course, pay a per gallon charge when we fill up the tank that goes to our roads and our highways, but that doesn't even raise enough money just to cover the cost of constructing and maintaining the road system. But from both an environmental and an economic perspective, we really ought to be paying far more than the cost of simply constructing and maintaining the roads, given the environmental costs of our driving habits in the roads. Our roads are fragmenting habitat across the landscape. They're the biggest source of impervious surface that changes the hydrology of our streams and wetlands. They're the biggest source of the stormwater pollutants that are largely coming from our cars that are affecting our water quality across the region. Our cars, in turn, are the biggest sources of both air pollution and greenhouse gases in our region. And, you know, though we typically, when we talk about using a gasoline tax strategically, you know, we're generally thinking about things like trying to lower our dependence on foreign oil or so on, but that you know, is generally done at the federal level. But these environmental costs, other than greenhouse gases, are essentially all born here. And any sort of tax that was strategically trying to address them really should be both raised and spent here in the region. And the amount that we're talking about, when a study was done recently of the gasoline tax in Great Britain and the United States, it found that if it was set just to cover the public cost of air pollution alone, it ought to be about 40 cents per gallon. Extending the sales tax to gasoline won't even get you to there. But it will raise a very substantial amount of money, and also can raise consciousness. Lastly, an environmental impact fee on development. Local governments are authorized in this state to charge impact fees on development for the infrastructure necessary to serve them, the roads, schools, utilities, and so forth. But most local governments don't charge anywhere near the full amount, and so the rest of us, through our general taxes, are subsidizing that development, those costs, are for at least $20,000 for a new house. Now, the environmental impacts from new development are very similar to these infrastructure impacts. Just as a development contributes new traffic to local roads, new students to local schools, they're altering the environment cumulatively in a way that trying to mitigate the impacts of this subdivision and that subdivision separately never is going to be able to address. If we set an impact fee of just $5,000 per new house, which would be a conservative figure, we could be raising at least $120 million a year across the region. Now, are these ideas, you know, just kind of, you know, wacko, you know, political fancy by some Seattle liberal? Well, you know, I don't think so, and I don't think so for a variety of reasons. First of all, you know, much of the rest of the world has already begun introducing these types of taxes and shifting other taxes away. So they're lowering income taxes and other sorts of taxes and putting more of the burden on these things. Second of all, here within this country, you know, there was a contest just a couple years ago run by the Service Employees Union, the so-called Cent Slice Bread Contest, for best public policy ideas. And the contest included both an expert review of proposals, but also a popular internet vote across the country. The contest was run by a union, and it really had more of a labor focus on things like, you know, minimum wage, education, so on. And yet the number one idea in that contest was essentially environmental sin taxes. You know, this is Peter Skidmore here, a Nature Conservancy scientist in Seattle, who actually contributed that idea, winning his $100,000 check. My wife had suggested that I submit my idea, or that I said, oh, you know, I don't have time. You know, it looked to me that that really wasn't their focus, but in fact, it still was the winner of the whole contest. Is the amount of money that we're talking about just something that, you know, we'd never be willing to spend? Well, I would argue it really depends on what you're used to. We've already spent it in the Columbia, largely through higher electrical rates to try to provide flows needed for salmon. But in the Columbia, you know, we haven't really addressed the fundamental ways in which we've changed that ecosystem. While $10 billion here in the Puget Sound region really could begin to change the fundamental ways we're affecting our ecosystem. And perhaps, you know, the most significant argument is that this really is a way that we could be reducing property and sales taxes and other taxes that the general populace is bearing. If we set these environmental sin taxes at the sort of rates that I talked about before, we could be raising about $1 billion a year. If we began to charge full impact fees, like they do in California, pretty much across the state, we would be raising another about $500 million a year. The cost of the conservation program I've talked about might be around $500 million. That would leave about $1 billion a year for tax reduction, up to $2.50 per 1,000 assessed valuation across the entire Puget Sound region. And I think this is a proposal that at least some Republicans could get behind. Now, money is not the only issue that we need to address, but I would argue that we really have a head start on most of the other significant components of a regional conservation strategy. You know, first and perhaps foremost in some ways, we live in one of the most beautiful parts of the world, and that generates its own political support for conservation. The Growth Management Act, though I argue in the book, it has some fundamental ways that it really needs to be changed if we're going to achieve this conservation in the long run. It is probably the best state framework for land use from an ecological perspective in the entire country. The Northwest Forest Plan has been outstanding in trying to protect old growth in our region. And though many would argue that we ought to be doing more on our state and private forests, we still are really doing more than just about any other state in the country right now. And I would argue in the case of private forests in this region, we probably have gone as far as that regulatory baseline is going to go. If we want more, we will need to be providing some compensation if we aren't going to see a lot of that land convert over to development, which is the last thing that we're looking for. Salmon recovery planning, though it has, you know, some of the weaknesses I've talked about before, it has at least gotten the right people talking to each other, and it has identified typically the most important specific projects that we'd want to put our initial money towards. Cascade Land Conservancy, Nature Conservancy, Trust for Public Lands, a whole range of nonprofits around here have really done excellent work that we can build on. And last but not least, we may have a legal hammer here that really isn't available in other parts of the country. People, I think, are generally familiar with the Bolt decision and the fact that the tribes have a right to harvest half of the salmon in our region. But there was a second phase to that lawsuit that's currently working its way through the courts right now. That relates to whether the tribes have a right to the protection of the habitat necessary to produce the fish that they have a right to harvest. And I think you're going to find that the answer to that question legally will be yes. Exactly how that's articulated, no one can really tell you right now, but that is probably going to have a bigger impact on land and water management in this region than the Endangered Species Act has had so far. Now, are we facing serious challenges here to accomplish this? Of course we are. And I would argue in some ways that the most significant challenge is that the scale of the problem is just simply not what we've been set up to address, both geographically and across time. The most significant losses that we're seeing are occurring incrementally at a pretty good distance from where most of us live. It's very different from Lake Washington becoming polluted right at the doorstep of the Seattle area. And what I've found when I've delivered this talk to state and federal agency staff is that the staff actually get this issue quite well. They're very supportive of the arguments. But the agencies definitely don't support it, or at least have had a hard time going along with it, in significant part because they really are not set up to address these issues. This is not part of their mission. And what we ultimately need to have is a change in the long-term orientation of those institutions and a change in the geographic scale that we're focusing on for our governance. It needs to be beyond just the city and counties, but it doesn't necessarily need to be at the overall state level. And to accomplish that, you know, we're going to be having one of our most significant obstacles just simply being the political and cultural divide between rural and urban areas here in Puget Sound and, you know, much of the rest of the country. But this type of proposal, I think, could begin to try to address those issues with giving rural people more of a voice in some of the governance questions, providing compensation to landowners. One way or the other, getting over that divide is absolutely crucial to being able to succeed with this sort of thing over the long term. And lastly, trying to raise, you know, $10 billion or so. I've given you my ideas on how to do it, but obviously that's a huge challenge. But though the challenges are daunting, I would argue that conceptually it's actually fairly simple in terms of what we need to do. It really starts with thinking of the region as an ecosystem, as a connected landscape. And then letting the land speak first, just like they did with the conservation scenario in the Willamette. Saying, let's let the natural features of that landscape be the primary determinant of where we focus our conservation efforts and where we anticipate impacts from growth. And lastly, to recognize that we are all in this together, people in rural areas, people in urban areas, people in central Puget Sound and south Puget Sound, the Olympic Peninsula. We have different roles to play, but we all have a stake, and our children and grandchildren all have a stake in whether or not we succeed. I want to conclude with a favorite quote of mine. If we're going to change the way we act about conservation in this region, we first need to change the way we think about it. And if the people at the top are going to change the way they think, like, it's only going to happen through pressure from the bottom up. I found when I've spoken with people who've been closely involved with the development of the governor's proposal, typically, they actually say, you know what, John, I really actually agree with most of what you have to say, but, you know, what we're proposing, it's a good first step. It's better than nothing. But I would argue that better than nothing is a very uninspiring platform, particularly when it's clear that it won't get you anywhere close to what your goals have been set at. The Cascade Land Conservancy took a very different approach with the Cascade Agenda. They tried to dream big in the central Puget Sound region. And that big dream created enthusiasm and excitement for the thousands of people who ended up contributing to the details of their agenda for that part of our region. Like now we need to extend that dream to the rest of the Puget Sound area and have a big enough vision to recognize that we're all sharing this 16,000 square mile ecosystem. We are all in this together, and together we can achieve an alternative future for our region. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to take questions and discussion. I've submitted comments to the legislature on that and actually had a pretty good conversation with some of the legislators working on it. And the three fundamental points that I made are that first, deciding your governance structure before you've really decided what you're going to do is backwards. And they really should, at this point, view this more as kind of the next step to clarify what they really would propose to do. But ultimately, you want your governance structure to help, you know, ensure, you know, you're implementing things in the best way possible. And looking at that, the two places are the two, you know, sources of involvement that I think have been neglected relative to what they ultimately would need to be are, first of all, county governments and local governments in general, because they are crucial to land use, and land use is ultimately central to this whole vision for the region. And second of all, some way of giving rural people a special role, given their crucial place politically in making this happen or not across the landscape. And my book makes a proposal for how there could be a kind of rural advisory committee directly elected by rural people, because right now, just kind of, you know, by the arithmetic of democracy, rural people are always outnumbered at the county level, and that has led to a real sense of disenfranchisement. And if they had an advisory committee that had a key role in things like compensation to landowners and other issues of greatest concern for them, that would require some sort of maybe supermajority vote of the governance structure to override, I think that would begin to address their feeling of you know, not having a say on things that are being done to them rather than done with them.
It's time for a warm welcome.